Welcome to What's Hot in Indie RPGs and Story Games. I'm your moderator. My name is Abishri Richard. This is your panel. If I may introduce first, Anita Murray, who is the Contribution to Irish Gaming winner in 2013 and the Irish National Game Writer Award winner for 2012, as well as organising design playstorms for London Indie Meet. She's also the founder and editor-in-chief of The Gazebo, an Irish and UK-based online RPG zine. So, Anita, thank you for joining us. And what game is exciting you at the moment?
Okay, the game that's exciting me at the moment is Blades in the Dark, which is one of the most successfully Kickstarter games of 2015. It's due out in 2016, but very much, I think, a lot of, when you're talking about what's hot in indie games, I think very often, you are talking about things that are just being kickstarted, because that's the point where you have access to the designers and you've got access to the design team. Blades in the Dark, designed by John Harper, who's done Lady Blackbird, The Mustang, Ghost Echo, and numerous others, kind of really, really awesome games. The PDF he's got out, so if you've backed the Kickstarter, you have a PDF that you can play test. It's almost complete, but it is not the final finished product. But one of the reasons why I really, really love this game is for a couple of reasons. The first is that the setting is amazing. It's one of the richest settings I've come across in story games. And this event has happened called the Cataclysm. And so you have shattered islands that are all kind of under one rule of the Imperium. And in between these kind of islands, who are almost kind of city-state, you've got the Deadlands, where the unquiet dead roam. The game, Blades in the Dark, is focused on Duskwall, which is a port city. And you basically create a criminal enterprise, which is one of the things I love. So you play scoundrels on the streets in this industrial city where you have primitive electrical technology, you have like the printing press, strange alchemy, and kind of really simple kind of gunpowder weapons. And one of the things that I love about what John Harper's doing in Blades in the Dark is the system he's created, I think, is the best system we have at the moment for action-fueled adventure games. I think very often when you get into story games, they're often very, very narrative-driven, and they're always about building consensus at the table. What John Harper's doing is just going, yeah, let's build consensus, but really the kind of the bleed that you have from action, all of that comes from when that consensus stops at the dice roll, and then you have to step back into being the audience. So every dice roll basically drives the narrative forward. Every single dice roll has a consequence and it changes the system. And it's all very action-based and it's all very, very physical. So every single dice roll drives the narrative. It puts kind of new information into the story. The characters bounce back off it, and it's all about action and reaction in a really, really beautiful and elegant way. The other thing that I really love is he talks about it. He's kind of styled his system as fiction-first gaming. So the idea is that your choices in a role-playing game aren't immediately constrained by the mechanics. They're constrained by the established fictional situation. So the idea is that mechanics are brought into play after the fictional action, which determines which mechanics are used. So what he's doing is doing a really great bridge between kind of traditional games and story games, and it's creating that bridge of the system is much crunchier than I think most story games are. It's much closer to older, kind of more traditional role-playing games. But what he's doing is that he's used skimming down systems that you would be very familiar with, and he's creating a story-driven narrative and tying that into a traditional role-playing game and creating this really, really beautiful, elegant, action-driven adventure game. So I think everyone should play it and check it out because it's amazing.
Great. Thank you, Anita. So moving around. So Becky Anderson is the designer behind When the Dark is Gone, a game published in the upcoming Seven Wonders Anthology by Pelgrane Press. She's also recently completed a successful Kickstarter campaign for Lovecraft-esque with her co-designer and partner Josh Fox. Becky is interested in how we can better understand and experience emotions in role-playing from the joyful to the cathartic, and she's passionate about inclusivity and diversity in gaming. So thank you for joining us, Becky. And what game is interesting you at the moment?
Thank you. Well, I've been a bit of a cheat, and I've gone with actually quite an old game, but it's a game I think deserves an awful lot more love than it gets.
When you say quite an old game, it's been out for like 2 years.
Yeah, it's been 6 months.
It's been kickstarted, and the Kickstarter has actually delivered its print.
Yes. Yeah, something like that. So the game is It Just By, and I'm now going to apologise to the authors for mangling their names, but it's by Ulle Pedergera and Martin Bill Gunbundsen, who are Norwegian. And the setting of It Just By is a sort of a between the wars in a European city, which injects a lot of elements of surrealism. So surrealism is a school of art, in the Surrealist School of Art, it's the idea that elements from dreams sort of become reality. And this is a game where elements that are surreal or are dream-like just live in the city as everyone else does. And I think it's a very nice setting, but that's not why I love this game. I love this game because I think it has a number of very elegant mechanics, and the reason I want to give it some love is because I'd like to see either this game hacked by somebody, or I'd like to see the mechanics that are in it taken out and applied to other games. So the first thing is that conflicts in It Just By are resolved using yes, but, no, and cards. These cards come from Archipelago, I think, originally, but I think they actually start right back with a variety of different improv games in the acting community. And so the idea is that any time you have a conflict, there's a deck of cards on the table, the person who is at the centre of the conflict, the player, gets to pull the card, and then it will say, no, but, X. And the person who's pulled the card is the person who decides what happens. So the first thing that I love about it is, although this is a GM game, it's got a really clear, really focused mechanic for dividing up creative control, because the person who gets to decide the result of a conflict is the person who drew the card, which I think is very lovely. It has a second deck in it, and because this is a game with a lot of surrealism in it, it's called the Chance Deck, and the Chance Deck is about injecting a little bit more surrealism. And so you might pull a card, and the card has to be resolved immediately. So no matter where you are in the action, you have to resolve the card. And the card might say things like, flash forward 3 hours. Or it might say, the paintings on the wall start to narrate something at you. Or something like that, because it's a game about surrealism. And what I like about that, and this is a mechanic I'd really like to see in other games, is that, obviously, the players have on their character sheets a lot of prompts about things that they can improvise off, creative prompts that they can use to inject material into the game. The GM will have prepared information and material they can inject into the game. But what this does is when you've all got all of that information on your character sheet or your GM notes, I think sometimes you can lose a bit of focus because you've almost got like too much to try and assimilate into what you're running or what you're saying. What these cards do is they really hone your focus down on, this is a single thing that is happening, it is very surreal, it's going to amp up the surrealism in the game, and we're all going to focus on it for a brief period of time. And the third thing that I love is actually in the GMing advice section. I think that one of the things that's really good about indie games is that their GMing advice sections often tend to be a lot more detailed, I think, I would say.
And specific. To the kind of story they're looking to tell.
Precisely, than you get in sort of more traditional A4 style games. And the GMing advice in It Just By, which I think is so beautiful, tells you how to GM a game and incorporate what the player's doing. So it gives you ideas for how to structure scenes very loosely. It gives you ideas for how to take NPCs that your players have created, add extra motivations to them. And it allows you to GM in a very loose way, so you're constantly reincorporating the player's material. But it gives you enough of a framework so you're not having to do all of the creative work on the fly. And I think there's a really good section in It Just By about that I'd like to see kind of, I think, could be applied very widely and could be very helpful in all sorts of other GMing style, similar style games.
Okay, thank you very much, Becky. So, Joanna Piancastelli is a London-based indie game developer. her superhero freeform LARP on Heroes won the 2014 Golden Cobra Challenge, and her new tabletop game, Before the Storm, has just been published in the Seven Wonders Anthology. Her upcoming game, Headcanon, will feature in the London Indie RPG Meetup Group Anthology next year. So, Joanna, thanks for coming along.
Hi.
And what game is exciting you at the moment?
Yeah, I'm going to do something a little bit controversial and talk about something that's actually, like, just out.
Oh.
Really, it's neither upcoming nor ancient by comparison. So, yeah, the Seven Wonders Anthology has made it to the Pelgrane stand this morning. What I love about this book is that it's almost like a really nice little introduction to story gaming. There's seven games in it. Most of them are scenario-based, so they set up a particular space where the characters are going to be, and then you tell a story, and I think most of them run in a sort of fairly traditional 4-hour story narrative slot. I think some of them actually have a little bit of space to breathe, and if you did want to make sort of an evening-y, dinner party sort of time out of them, you could definitely make that stretch out over something that's not necessarily a traditional gaming experience. I think all of them are put together in a way that would help guide people who don't necessarily know the world of story gaming into something that they haven't tried before. So if you've got your hardcore D&D players who maybe want to try something new, there's actually quite a lot of options in here. One thing that I really like, actually, this is a bit of genius on Kat's part, is the sort of spread of genres that ended up in the book. So there's a creating a dystopia, which could go anywhere. There's an already existing cyberpunk dystopia. There's some hard sci-fi. There's some high fantasy. There's some lower fantasy. There's some really heartwarming little interpersonal stories set in each of those genres. So I've played two of the games in here. I'm not going to talk about mine, but I am going to talk about Heroes of the Hearth, which is Stian Eve's game. And that is, it's such a sweet story about a group of people who get left behind when their adventuring friends and family go off on their grand epic quest, and it's all about the people that get left behind and the stories that happen just in their village. Play develops in response to the stories that's going on there, and then occasionally they get little scraps of news from their adventuring friends and family, and that can really change the game. It's like we had a playtest and everything was sort of going along, and there was one character who was having quite a nice time of things at home and everything was sort of going right for her, and then she found out that her precious little sister had died on the quest, and it massively changed things up. And I think there's a, like, while all of these games are quite scenario driven and they do work in that sort of free-formy way of starting you in a place and letting you generate characters and then say, you know, the story you tell might have a similar arc, I think every single time you're going to get something quite different out of them, and that's what I'm really enjoying about flicking through this book this morning.
Okay, so thank you very much. And now to Rob. Robert Carnell discovered role-playing through the world of Warlock of Firetop Mountain and has been going left at T-junctions ever since. He began reviewing RPGs in 1993 with the zine Carnell, and he's currently the editor of the web zine The Rapture, in which he reviews many new experimental games and writes about the techniques and theories of role-playing. He's also one of the most prolific GMs in the London indie scene. So Rob, what game is exciting you at the moment?
So I'm obviously going to follow the rules that you set down to the letter by talking about two games. And I'll explain why I'm going to get away with this. So the two games I've chosen are Public Access and Transmission. And they have an unusual relationship. Public Access is by Jason Cordova, and it forms the basis of a game that he submitted to a role-playing challenge called the Three Forged Challenge, which we'll come to a little bit later. So Transmission is public access that has gone through two other designers' hands. So the basic idea in both games is the same, but they're kind of quite different expressions of it. So Public Access is about a group of internet forum dwellers, you might say conspiracy theorists, who have discussed a strange TV show they remember from their childhood. That's one of the immediate attractions. I think we can all think about our childhood, about a weird TV show that we didn't quite understand at the time and seemed to have quite adult themes dressed in. And Transmission is about it's a sci-fi setting where a colony in the future has lost contact with Earth and a rescue mission has to go and find out what's happened to it. But both games are essentially about mysteries.
And sorry, Rob, just to clarify, so he wrote Public Access, or like the first bit of it, handed it on to other designers, that ended up as Transmission, and then he carried on designing his original concept to be Public Access.
So I know we're being recorded, so I'll try not to libel anyone, but what I think happened was is that he had a really good idea,
right,
submitted it to the Three Forged Challenge,
right,
wasn't very impressed by what came out of it in the form of Transmission, and then published Public Access,
okay,
as being more close to his vision of what the game should have been. And I admire that, but I think actually the other designers did add something,
okay,
to the basic design. So it's a personal opinion, but I think Transmission is the better game. But I have played both, and they have slightly different strengths. Yeah, but they're both about mysteries. And so the game has a way of discovering facts about the world and then resolving and investigating them. But what's really interesting is it doesn't bring it to a conclusion. And in the end of both games, it is up to the players to try and put forward their explanation of what the facts they've discovered mean. You know, why was the show created? What is the show about? What's happened to the colony? Where are the colonists? Should the colony be abandoned or start, should it be a new effort be made to
colonise the planet? Was it chance or is it fate? And as a kind of stepping back from the aesthetics of the game to the structure and design of the game, what's interesting is that I think it's at the end of a continuum, right? So if we think back to the earliest role-playing games where you literally draw out dungeon on graph paper, it's finite, it's discrete. Once you've explored every room in the dungeon, killed every monster, taken every piece of treasure, it's done, right? You've discovered all there is. And we move from kind of that dungeon crawling to the idea of exploring someone's narrative idea, usually the person facilitating or GMing it. But it's still discrete, right? That person has an idea of a story or a topic they're trying to convey. Then in story gaming, we kind of shared that narrative responsibility, but the commitment was then to the story. There is still a discrete story, and we kind of use things like reincorporation to get to a conclusion that's satisfying to the players. And in this game, there isn't a conclusion. There isn't any nice reincorporation. It's fine for five people to leave the table with five different ideas of what has happened. The game has rules to say what things are concrete and shared between them, but they're merely statements of fact, not of interpretation or ideas. And that's been fascinating for me for the last 3 or 4 months. Mm.
So thank you very much, Rob. So that's Blade in the Dark, Idris By, Seven Wonders, and Transmission/Public Access. But if we want to move on to stuff that's kind of happening in the wider community, let's pick up what you were just talking about, the Three Forge competition, and indeed design competitions in general.
Yeah, so this year didn't seem to me to have a standout game of the year that everyone agreed was amazing and kind of pushed things forward. But the thing that was recurring throughout the year was all these different competitions and challenges. The first standout one for me was the 200 words competition, which I think did a really interesting thing because it was very open. It said, write a game, a skin, a hack, write something in 200 words or less. Mm. That initially seems to be a big constraint, right? 200 words isn't very much. But actually, when you get into it, it's really liberating, right? So most people who try to write a game or create something just get bogged down in all the things that could happen. And the 200 words challenge really kind of boiled it down and said, like, what's the idea? What's the interesting thing? And just get that down. And
you're done. Or I guess, what is the one mechanic you want to use? Because you really don't have space for more than a couple of mechanics.
Yeah, yeah. And some of the games are just literally ideas. You know, yeah. So say they have mechanics as charitable.
Yeah, yeah. My game, Unresolved Sexual Tension, was certainly just an idea.
And what an idea.
What an idea.
Yeah, but also the skins and hacks, the idea that you can write a small extension to a game in 200 words or less, also brought down the barrier further. So you can assume that what you've written has a people with a body of knowledge that you can share, and you're just expanding it by this tiny amount. And I think that...
I heard an interview with the person who created that channel.
Yeah.
So it was on Tabletop Superhighway. Yeah. And he said it actually happened, the whole competition happened by accident.
Yes.
Is that he said, I will set a challenge for myself to write an RPG in 200 words. And then he suddenly got replies from other people saying, oh, here's my 200 words RPG. And what are the prizes and whether you judge
And I think that's absolutely true, that's an accident. But I think the difference is that, you know, when opportunity comes knocking, do you go like, oh no, I was just doing it for myself?
Yeah.
He created a website, allowed people to submit it, got a judging crew together, did have prizes donated, and ran with it, right? And
there were hundreds of entries,
aren't there? Yeah, I know. It's like I'm still going through them. It's like in terms of the competition. So it's 200 words. Three Forge was also interesting. I'll come back to it. There was another year of Golden Cobras, another game of Game Chef. 24-hour RPG I haven't even touched.
Yeah.
It was really interesting. It had a random idea generator.
There was a fiasco.
Yeah. I'm roughly round about September, yeah. I think, in terms of getting through reading these entries. You know. It's like next year I'm looking forward to kind of going through the Golden Cobras and stuff.
And the Warbirds Kickstarter had a competition embedded within it.
To have
your game published in the anthology.
Yeah. And while we're calling these competitions or challenges, I think what was really interesting was that they weren't competitive in the normal sense. They were people setting down constraints that then seemed to inspire people, which was really good. So the Three Forge Challenge one was one of the most interesting structurally for me. So the idea was that I think the first person writes less than 1,000 words and then submits their manuscript back to the centre, to the coordinator. The coordinator then randomly assigns a second author who writes up to about 3,000 words. and then the third author writes up to about 5,000 words, and that's the final manuscript. And actually, out of all the games, I think only one maybe didn't make it through all three stages, which is quite an amazing commitment, because while you might be quite invested in your own idea, you had to be invested in two other people's ideas to get them done. So the kind of trust in a community of collaboration was amazing. There was quite an interesting rule that you didn't have to take anything from the previous manuscript. One of the reasons it's taken me a long time to go through the entries, because I have, for some of the games, I've read the different iterations, the three versions of the same game. And it's like, well, yeah, you know, like that person who did the final writing had a definite idea for what this game was. There is nothing from
it. I took words in the first 1,000 words. I took A,
yes,
B.
I took A, the, and. What do you want from me? But I think the best ones were the ones that did build on the idea. And one that stood out for me was, I can't remember, it's Trauma Medical Center. It's about being an A&E doctor. And slightly depressingly, one of the authors did some research. And when
like, gone, fell off a ladder.
No. did some background reading on emergency medicine. When you go and get treated for emergency medicine, your doctor can make a mistake that will kill you, but their ability to influence a positive outcome for you is very low. So essentially, when you arrive in trauma, it is things like your age and your preconditions and your general disposition to the injury that you've had that affects your outcome. So doctors are in the very shitty situation that they can make things a lot worse for you, but they can't really make them better. So once that person had researched that piece, because the original game is all like simulationist, you have skills and you're different medical operations you can do on people, and patients have challenge ratings, and you've got to kind of manage your time. It's all kind of it's like RuneQuest for doctors. And the game that came out of it, basically, you have just tokens, right? So you can push yourself to get a better dice roll, but then you get subsequently a penalty. So if you push yourself, there is a vague chance that you might affect the outcome for the first patient, but then you negatively impact every other patient you have. So it was a game that was completely deceptive as well, because it didn't explain to you the rules. It was like, you've got to treat patients, and you still have certain percentage skills, and there's certain, you know, like you diagnose things, and then you've got to get the right specialist in, and your Tidings tokens, you know, they have penalties. And then at the end of the game, like, when it comes to the conclusion, it's like, so this is what you did. If you pushed yourself in any way to help a patient, you adversely affected all the other patients you'd had.
So that's just kind of one game that came out of Dreamforce. Are there any other kind of like points that you want to draw out of the year in terms of design competitions?
I think it just comes back to the idea that they were constraints that drove things forward.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how certain I am in saying this, but I think it was people playing around with the craft of game design.
Yeah.
So last year we saw things playing around with the medium. Generally, game design is about aesthetics, right?
So that was last year's Game Chef of There Is No Book as an ingredient.
Yeah. You know, games like Carolina Deathcrawl, Disco World, Graham Wormsley saying Disco World here, you can go and buy it, you should.
Yeah.
But the idea that through card play, the story you want emerges due to the properties of drawing things in a particular order. So that's playing around with the physicality, the material, the...
But this year was all about constraints and about how the constraints kind of inspired different designs.
Yeah, and challenging the rules of what games are. So generally, a role-playing game is a system of play written by an author. And attached to that is a lot of fiction that is quite often written by many authors. And if you're very lucky, the fiction matches the system. But what the hell, if the system's good, the fiction doesn't really matter. And if the system's bad, the fiction doesn't save it for most people. But this is genuinely challenging some of the ways that games are put together and saying, you know, yes, you can have a playable game in 200 words.
Yep.
Not anyone can pick up that game. So you learn something about the way that games are constructed.
Yeah.
Right? You have to make assumptions in 200 words of what people know. And so I think it's people playing around with the very fabric of games, pushing around with them in an interesting way. And it's not total. I think still most games are written on the basis of aesthetics.
Yeah.
You know, wouldn't it be great if, you know, the sea was cold and cities were on the back of whales and that's my game. But this is actually genuinely playing around with the nature of what is the needs of the expressible game to play with
games. Okay, so design competitions, one of the trends from 2015. So if I could move on to Anita, what would you like to talk about?
I'm going to talk about, I'm really, really in love with like collective game design. So at London Indie or PG Meetup, I used to run and still do these events called Playstorms. The idea is I'd set a theme, like into the woods, and then people would turn up, and then people would pitch game ideas. So game ideas, game mechanics, you get into a group of 4 to 5, you sit down, I set a timer, you've 3 hours to design a game. Games got designed in 3 hours, you take a break, games swap around, they get play tested. So in a 10-hour session, you could walk away with maybe 5 games designed to have had a fresh play test, and then people could walk away and finish those games up. So I was super excited about this kind of collective, grassroots, kind of creative collaboration. And literally, it was like at this seminar last year, we're kind of talking, we're going, we should totally do an anthology, because anthologies and indie games kind of work really, really well together. So this year, we've actually carried that forward in IndieMe, but it's been what's taken up pretty much all of my time for like 2015. It's due out in about, like, we're hoping 5-6 months, the 2016 May UK Games Expo. But it's really interesting. So last year I was talking about like this great high concept of like collaboration and creativity, and now 1 year later you're kind of talking about the nuts and bolts of, man, what's really useful in terms of indie games is getting a bunch of people together and talking about VAT. And, you know, like how you deal as like a self-employed kind of designer and you're getting extra income in. What do you need to know to kind of get yourself forward? Getting people tips on like how to do layout for yourself, making networks for people who do layout, getting people talking about art, people who have no artistic background, who just sitting down for the first time, it's like, you know what, here's a list of resources. Here's a list of copyright-free kind of images. Here's lists of people who are artistic, who you can do commissions for. And it's just about building that community of designers who are like first-time designers or on-the-ground designers. And very often, it's that wonderful point where most people are working full-time anyway. So this is all stuff that you're doing in your spare time, out of love and passion, and it's a massive learning curve, not just in terms of designing for the first time, but then sitting down and going, okay, so I'm now also going to be a production team and my own accountant, and I'm going to start investigating Kickstarters and promotion and trying to figure all of that out just as regular people. So that's what I'm super excited about. I'm excited about seeing the gaming community going from creating to now actually
producing
yeah. and kind of getting those kind of nuts and bolts skills to start producing games and moving forward. And that's amazing because we have 19 game designers in the anthology, which is amazing. So that's like 19 people like in spare time trying to kind of keep track of how they're doing and how they're working and helping to kind of get the games kind of move forward. But we have some absolutely amazing games in it, and I'm really, really super excited about it.
So, and one of the things beyond explicit anthologies that I've also noticed is that where a game has come out, it's not just one person behind. Is that there is maybe one designer, but they're often thanking other people for their help, so they'll have engaged other people in the community in terms of layout or help and fulfillment. Magpie Games have several things that come out, like when Mars has come out by Brendan Conway, but actually there are several other people who are behind it who've helped out, and there are kind of consistent names that reappear again and again. And there's also been an interesting thing which I really should have noted down here about Monster of the Week, which is a Powered by the Apocalypse game about where you create games about basically there is a Monster of the Week and you need to go and investigate it. And it was released a few years ago by a guy called Michael Sands, and it was your typical self-published book, like kind of RPG. And now Evil Hat, who normally published Fate, have now licensed it from Michael and put a new cover around it and revised the version and put it out again this year. And obviously brought like a bunch of other kind of infrastructure to this game that otherwise, to be honest, would probably have faded away. And so the involvement or the greater ties from the community and the willingness for other people to just help each other, like whether advice or kind of with more explicit design and layouts.
Yeah, it's amazing. It is actually, I think the indie community, particularly the UK indie community, just in the last year and a half, there's been a massive push in design and production and getting games out. So there's a real feel that the UK indie scene is coming up on the rise, and it's getting into a really, really exciting place where we're now actually going to be producing stuff that I think definitely can meet what the Americans are doing. And that's really exciting because you're getting an idea of what the UK scene is going to be producing. And yeah, and that degree of collaboration is just, it's amazing. Like, one of the other things that we've been, like, trying to compile, like, a Kickstarter for the anthology, And one of the things we've looked at doing is talking to a lot of other UK designers who've obviously previously published games and kind of going, can we actually want to do a bundle that's going to be, this is the UK indie scene up till now. So you're getting like a good overview of what it's been like kind of in the bundle, and then as well like this kind of a bunch of like new designers. And
so the idea is you can get this anthology and you can also get this bundle that will include games that have been around for a couple of years, mm-hmm. but we've loved and influenced us, so there's stuff by kind of like some British designers. So I know John Keyworth has got kind of Intrepid in there, James Mullins provided a game, Graham Walmsley's provided a game, so cool. Yeah.
Gregor Hutton's
hopefully providing a game as well. So talking about British talent on the rise, I look over significantly at Becky, who has just had experience with a very successful Kickstarter. And so you can tell us about taking a product from both design and inspiration, getting it crowdfunded.
I think, firstly, I have to say that my co-designer and co-Kickstarter runner is in the audience, Josh Fox, who also actually won Freeforged.
There you go.
Oh.
And the story actually started here last year. Here last year, I popped over to Graham Walmsley's stall and I bought a copy of Stealing Cthulhu, which I've been meaning to buy for ages. For anyone who doesn't know about Stealing Cthulhu, it is just a gem of a book. And it really, it teaches you from the ground up how to run a Cthulhu story. And whether you want to use Call of Cthulhu or Act on Cthulhu or any of the other kind of Lovecraft systems out there, it's not system-based. It's about saying, I'm going to break down what the core of Lovecraft's stories were and show you how to create a really satisfying story as a GM to produce something that isn't investigators with shotguns, but is much closer to the kind of creeping cosmic horror of H.P. Lovecraft stories. And I sort of read this, and I sort of said to Josh one night, you know, I don't know why Graham just hasn't written a story game based on this, because he's basically written the blueprint for a story game, not a manual on how to run a really awesome, not just a manual on how to run an awesome Cthulhu game. So over Christmas, Josh and I pretty much wrote it and said to Graham, hey Graham, we've written this amazing game based off your book. And he said, that's fantastic, you'll be hearing from my lawyers. And then after the Christmas break, we thought, you know, gosh, well, we really want to get this out there. You know, we think we've got something really good here. And Josh said, well, let's Kickstarter it. And I said, we can't Kickstarter it. Nobody knows who we are. Nobody will buy it. This is ridiculous. He said, no, I really think we can Kickstarter it. And I think that because we felt that we were quite unknowns in the market, we did a number of very specific things to increase our chances of having a successful Kickstarter. And I will say that even though we had done these things, I was still utterly blown away by how well we did. I really wasn't expecting it to go. I think we got 300% of our funding, and I was thinking, oh, we might squeak 100% if we're lucky. I really wasn't expecting it to go the way it did. But some of the things that we did, because we were new and nobody knew who we were, the first thing we did was that we invested some of our own money in getting some really stellar artwork, because actually I think a lot of the really good Kickstarters that get funded often have a really, really strong visual piece. So that was the first thing we did. I appreciate that's not open to everybody. We contacted professional layout artists and got a sample, just two sample pages, because we felt we didn't have the layout skills and we wanted people to see when they came to our Kickstarter page that we had somebody on board who was a known name in the industry for doing good layouts, good solid layouts. Nathan Paletta, he's fabulous to work with if anyone has the opportunity. But we wanted people to see two sample pages of a very professional looking layout and to have the confidence that we were getting somebody who was going to do a really good job, and that was factored into the costs. One of the things that we did was that, or Josh in particular, looked at, I can't remember how many campaigns you looked at now, but I think he looked at sort of 10 really successful Kickstarter campaigns, and we did a breakdown of how many of them had really high tier rewards, what percentage of the money for the campaign was coming from the high tier or coming from just people just buying PDFs. And there was a very, very clear trend about where the percentages of money in particular Kickstarters were coming from, in successful Kickstarters, where they were coming from, a particular breakdown in the reward tiers that you had in Kickstarters. The next thing that we did was that, although we're not terribly well known, we do hang out on G+ a lot, which is where a lot of the indie people hang out, particularly a lot of the American guys hang out on G+. We spend a lot of time on G+, and we contacted a lot of the people we knew on G+, who we hoped would write stretch goals for us, and indeed Scott Dorward said yes, which was awesome. And so we had a list of stretch goal writers, many of whom were quite well-known names in the industry, even though Josh and I were not, and we kind of convinced them that, you know, we've got something really solid here, we've done our homework, we've done our finances, we are going to be able to deliver. But I think having names like Jason Morningstar was writing a stretch goal for us, Graham Walmsley agreed to do a stretch goal for us. One of the things that was also very important to Josh and I is that Lovecraft is a very problematic subject. I think everybody in the room knows that Lovecraft is very problematic. He has problems with racism, he has problems with sexism, and whilst we didn't want to push that under the carpet and pretend it didn't exist, we didn't want our game to extend a canon unconsciously in those directions. So when we picked our stretch goal writers, we wanted to have the voices of women in our stretch goal writers, we wanted to have the voices of people of colour in our stretch goal writers, and so we made sure that we had a good balance of just a really diverse range of people, because I am a real believer that diversity gets you better product. We did a huge amount of marketing, which was absolutely exhausting.
I presume social media marketing.
Social media marketing, but we got invited, we pitched to be on a lot of people's blogs and podcasts, and as the campaign gathered momentum, people started approaching us, which was just amazing. But for kind of about 3 weeks, I really had to tense up and say, right, I know it's going to be awful contacting all these people to say, please talk about us on your podcast, you know, because self-promotion is, I think, actually one of the hardest things to do in Kickstarter.
But obviously, when you're essentially calling all these people, what did you find out actually resonated with them? Those who contacted you back, did they come back and say, oh, I was really interested in this particular aspect of it?
I didn't find it was that so much. Well, I mean, we did have a couple of unique selling points. Partly it was the diversity in the way that we were approaching the subject material. Partly, and I should have mentioned this earlier, for which I apologise, is that the way this story game is structured is that there is only one character. That one character, as in Lovecraft stories, where there is only one character, that one character rotates amongst all the players. Everybody gets a chance to play them. The person who is GMing or narrating the story rotates amongst the players, and for those players who are neither narrating nor playing the witness, as we call them, we had to watch characters or people who sit on the sidelines, and if they see an opportunity to inject some Lovecraftian cosmic horror-y detail into a scene that's been described, they just kind of gently step in and say, and you notice X horrible detail in the scene. So everybody has something to do around the table, but we brought our focus very tightly down to, this isn't five people with shotguns. This isn't even five people running away from Cthulhu. It's one person slowly uncovering something terrible, and at the end, if they don't die, then something terrible is going to happen to them.
That's a really great terminology. So you had the social media invitations, so you cold calling essentially the kind of like significant bloggers and so forth. Anything else?
It actually goes back to what Anita says, which is we asked for help. We really did ask for help. There's so many people out there who have done this before. So one person I really want to give a lot of credit to is Anna Kreider. Anna Kreider has run a number of successful Kickstarters. I think probably her most successful game is Thou Art But a Warrior, which is amazing and wonderful. And she very generously gave us an hour of her time over a Google Hangouts where we could ask her all the questions, and we sort of said to her, you know, what are the pitfalls, what should we be looking out for? And she was the person who helped us put a contingency fund in. If you ever run a Kickstarter, put a big contingency fund in. Because things like, Anna ran a Kickstarter recently where her entire contingency fund and a large amount of her personal profit was wiped out by a fluctuation in the Canadian currency. And so little things like that can actually massively change the financial viability of what you're doing. So Anna Kreider was just absolutely wonderful. Graham Walmsley, Jason Morningstar were very supportive, gave us lots of help and advice. Scott was incredibly supportive and pimped us on his podcast, which was so lovely. But I think that the thing that I realised throughout this entire process, or that we realised throughout this entire process, is it takes a village to raise a Kickstarter. You know, Josh and I were the people at the front of it, but there were tens of people, you know, 30, 40 people, from playtesters to people like Scott to Anna, giving us help, support and advice.
Yeah. So, a great success story. And moving on from, hey, you've got a successful Kickstarter, Joanna.
The thing that I want to talk about is the culture of playtesting that we're in at the moment. So it's kind of a running joke when we do the seminar every year, where we go, what game do we want to talk about? And all of us say, can we talk about this game that isn't released yet?
It's not available for purchase anywhere.
Anywhere. Because it's the latest thing that's in Kickstarter. And I mean, Dragon Meat has this thing. October to November is a very, very common time to kickstart games for various reasons up and down the calendar. But it means that a lot of what's really hot and what's really under people's microscope at that time is what's just finished kickstarting. Most big Kickstarters now go live with playtest materials ready to go. So as soon as you pledge your money, you can get the PDF, and it's got the basic rules at least, and you can take that and you can run the game. And it means that a lot of games that are smaller, indie games, have the kind of playtesting audience that, like, D&D 2nd Edition had. Like, the amount of people who are actually able to contribute to any one game before it meets its final form is tremendous these days. And I think that's, over the last year, I think that's taken off more than it was in previous years. You sort of started to see it with the November, October Kickstarters last year. But, I mean, Night Witches, for example, ran all the way through this time last year with people playing
the UK convention season.
Exactly, yeah. And then very recently, Masks, which you mentioned earlier, has seen a massive amount of play at Indie Meet. Headspace, which is looking really cool, also has really nice playtest materials. And you don't need much to get it out there, especially if you're running, you've got a sort of a commonly known system like Powered by the Apocalypse. People can just pick that up and run with it really, really quickly. And I think that's something that's fantastic. But I think we've also got a really growing sense of people having the confidence to bring a playtest of their own to pitch at Indie Meet. So this time last year, again, we had maybe three or four people who were fairly regularly pitching, oh, you know, here's a game that I'm working on, or in the cases of some very confident people, here's a game I wrote on the bus on the way here. But this year, we've seen a lot of people, like really everyone has plucked up the courage and has brought something that isn't released, that they've never shown anybody before, but they want to put it on the table and they want to get feedback on it. I think it's tremendous how the community's coming together around that, because gamers all have opinions on how games work, and playtesting is a skill, and it's something that both the person running it and the people participating in it need to actually work on to get good at it. But the fact that as a community we're starting to do that, especially in the UK where I think it's been less of a thing, is just phenomenal. And it's really been a big year for community and playtesting.
And there's also been some good advice put out there about how to run an effective playtest.
Graham again has
Leftopia and that was a thread by, I think, Hannah Schaefer.
As well. Quite a lot of that recently come out. And I think that's something that people are only just starting to realise, is that it is a skill and you can't just put something on the table. But at the same time, people are going for it. And I think that's phenomenal, which is, that's a shift that we've seen this year more than anything, I think.
So thank you very much, Joanna. We've been talking an awful lot. Let's hear from you guys. We have time for maybe a couple of questions.
Yeah, thanks for these very interesting presentations. And we've been talking a lot about UK developments and a little bit about US, but what about the rest of Europe? Or the rest of the world, perhaps, but I assume it's very much also in Europe you would have seen developments.
Yeah, so it's interesting because of the way that social media is operating at the moment. We're seeing a lot of the US stuff on Google+. Most of the UK stuff happens on Facebook. We are sort of in touch with the rest of Europe, but it's actually less so than the UK. I know we've got a couple of people who are going to Festival and I know Mo wrote a Stockholm scenario this year, didn't he? So we massively connected with, and I think it's because the social media surrounding those happens in bubbles that ours don't intersect with quite so much.
The best connections that I see are the Scandinavian developments, because of the crossover that's happening between the Scandies and the Americans. A lot of Scandies reach out to Americans and post in. Sorry, you want
to? No, I was just agreeing, basically, and saying, the Scandinavians would tend to go to the US and not go via the UK.
Which is ridiculous when you think about it, but yeah, it's something that would be fantastic for us to do, because I'd love to be able to go to conventions in Europe rather than in America.
But French, German, Italian, Spanish,
yeah,
we really have no...
I've heard, although this is only rumour, but I have heard that in kind of the French scene there's a lot going on between a fusion between indie and OSR communities. Mm-hmm. These two communities tend to be quite separate in the UK and in the US, but in France they don't really see there's much of a separation. There's a greater fusion of indie techniques being imported into OSR style type games, and I think it would be quite interesting to see that coming over here and coming over the US actually, but I don't read any French, so
I want to pick up on that point, because I think we have to face the fact that the English speaking community is quite insular. It's huge, right? So if ideas are not being translated into English and presented, so I feel like Scandinavian games, that while Playground, for example, is being published and you could get it print on demand or PDF, I felt kind of better informed as a way of catching up on it. And there have been a number of Kickstarters this year to translate French, Spanish and Swedish games into English. I think we have to be realistic and say, if that material is only available in its native language, this wider English-speaking community, Canada, Australia, US and the UK, are not going to gravitate to it unless the person is looking for novelty, right? It's got to be available.
And I want to mention, I think Aquaterre.
Aquaterre, it's getting kickstarted.
Just won a Kickstarter
that's
as well.
French, is it?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Is that the satanic one or the Stone Age one? Worm,
I think I don't
worm,
think it's Stone
Aquaterre
Age.
And...
we have time for one final question.
Right, this is sort of more of a thought than a question, which is... Wait, no, I can phrase it as a question. Right. Do you think that part of the greater growth and broader popularity of American role-playing games, like we play loads of those over here, but they don't play ours much, is to do with the fact that people don't... people say that the reason why like steampunk novels are seen as tosh is because they haven't had a seminal work like Neuromancer, like Cyberpunk.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that... I'm not saying that the English RPGs are seen as tosh, just that they're not as popular. Do you think that's down to the fact that we don't have our own apocalypse work?
I was going to say, I don't think it is. I don't think it's because we don't have our own apocalypse world. I think that there has been quite a large surgence of indie RPG writing in the UK this year, and I nearly wanted to say that was a trend, not because I think it is a trend, because I think if I say it's a trend, then maybe it'll be a trend tomorrow. But the reason I think they're not getting played is because we're not playing them, actually. Mm-hmm. We're playing Apocalypse World. We're playing Monster Hearts. We're not playing games by James Mullen as much as we're playing games by Americans. And I say that because I'm looking at the year's most popular con and meetup games, and I don't think there's a single game on there designed by a Brit. So I would say I don't think it's that we've not got the games. I think it's because we're not giving them the love we should be.
I also do think there's a big element of we're not the US cons.
Yeah.
So a lot of game propagation happens at the conventions in America. All of the ones that are on there get played at Games on Demand at Gen Con, and that is one of the biggest places that they spread.
Great, I totally agree with those points.
Can I
really
just...
sorry. No. Oh.
Okay,
thanks.
Thank you very much.
Quick, say what you want in there.
You're exactly right, they're not as good.